Ars Electronica 2008. A new cultural economy.
So, everybody, welcome to the last half of the last session of the last day of the symposium. Next up, we have Elizabeth Stark, who is one of the leaders of the free culture movement. Elizabeth.
Thanks so much, Joy. Erstmal würde ich Hallo auf Deutsch sagen. Ich heiße Elizabeth Stark und mache meine Präsentation über freie Kultur. Leider auf Englisch, aber es gibt wirklich Amerikaner, die Deutsch können. Also. So like I just said in German, today the topic of my speech is going to be free culture. But I would actually like to start with a story. It's a story of a song called Amen Brother. It was created in the 1960s by a funk band called the Winston Brothers, who were kind of well-known at the time. It turns out that they actually won a Grammy for the song that was on the other side of this record. But in fact, this record ended up having more cultural significance. This is a song that has a drum solo that I will play right now, and it may sound familiar. Uh-oh, we need our audio. Yeah. Yes. Okay, my computer doesn't want to play audio very well. But in any case, this is a piece of audio that has actually come to represent many genres of music and has come to be a huge part of the cultural consciousness. And this is what is now known as the Amen Break. It's 6 seconds of a drum beat that has been appropriated by so many artists and musicians in such genres as hip-hop, drum and bass, jungle. In fact, there's an entire genre of music that is based upon this 6 second drum loop, namely drum and bass or jungle. And there's a documentary that's really great that I would recommend to all of you about the Amen Break that we'll watch just a short section of telling us about it.
The Amen Break. Here's what it sounds like. Here, I'll play it again.
You can miss it the first time.
Now this break, despite its popularity and use over the last decade or so in contemporary culture, dates back almost 40 years. The Amen Break is a small piece of, and gets its name from, a song released in 1969 titled Amen Brother. Amen Brother was recorded by a funk and soul band who called themselves the Winstons. Amen Brother is the B-side of a single released by the Winstons titled Color Him Father. Color Him Father went on to win a Grammy Award for the band, becoming one of the top 100 hits of 1969. It's probably the track for which the band is best known. However, it's the B-side, Amen Brother, that has that classic drum breakdown right in the middle of the song, which makes it perfect for sampling. Here it is again, with more of the rest of the track included to give it context. So, Amen Brother was recorded, it was released, it was played, it came and went. Nothing terribly remarkable about it. However, the drum loop in the middle of the song was resuscitated with the advent of the sampler in the 1980s. Just a brief aside about the sampler. This was a machine about the size of a VCR that allowed its user to record any sound into it for quick playback and arrangement. The sampler, as well as the turntable, were principal tools largely responsible for the birth and development of hip-hop. With a sampler, any drum beat, any guitar riff, any sound that could be recorded could be used as part of a new composition, a new contextualization. Nowadays, almost all commercially produced music has been at least in part realized with a sampler. But hip-hop and other electronic-based music genres pioneered the creative use of samplers, and the Amen Break was one of the first drum samples to be experimented with. Here's an early example, the track Words of Wisdom by New York duo Third Base, released in 1989.
So as you can hear, this 1 6-second drum loop has become a part of our popular culture. And in essence, it's a part of, I would argue, free culture. The concept of free culture is not in and of itself a new concept. And as we've known throughout history, there's been folk culture, there's this talk of standing on the shoulder of giants, and people have been sharing culture all throughout the years. But here's an example of a 6-second loop that in fact was never actually licensed, but instead was appropriated by many artists and musicians, as I said, in genres such as jungle and hip hop, and as a result, resulted in this huge flourishing of culture that if it hadn't been available in this way, may not have happened. So although it is recorded that the original creators of the music never received any royalties for this song, it's a little bit complicated in US law because the copyright was a little bit different back then. But we have all this great culture, and many people have known them now as a result of this drum beat. So the story here to take away from this is that free culture is not new. It's not always legitimate. But the idea of a shared piece of culture can spawn on an endless amount of new culture. And to me, this is a perfect example of that. No. Sorry, we're having a... The joke is that whenever you have a presentation with techie people, the technology never works. Just that. But I'm trying to get my slide to switch, but it doesn't want to. There we go. Okay. I don't know if anyone recognized this. I asked some of my friends, and they couldn't quite figure it out. In fact, the logo looks a little bit like the Global Voices logo. But it's a concept that some of my friends and myself came up with about a cut, copy, and paste culture. And to me, this does represent the idea behind free culture, in that a shared cultural heritage and also cultural production can actually, as a result, be a good thing. And what is free culture? Because oftentimes, people, they hear this term, they don't know what it means. Free culture is the idea that the ability to access, share, and rework culture, it could be software code, it could be photos, text, music, art, film. The fact that it's a good thing. This doesn't necessarily mean that every single person must do that, but we think that for a shared cultural heritage, putting one's work out there is a positive thing. It also supports a framework of technological freedom that promotes such an environment. So if we have a locked-down technological environment, that's not very conducive to a free culture. So as I'll talk about later, we've done a lot of work on technological issues as well, such as free software and fighting against digital rights management. But needless to say, free culture is not only a concept that applies to geeks. In fact, I started the free culture group at Harvard, and in some cases, it was often a weird mix of people that would come to our meetings because we had the hardcore computer geeks and the coders, and then we had the musicians and artists, and we'd bring them together for a conversation, and often it worked. Sometimes we had a little bit of a disconnect between people talking about code and people talking about music. But in the end, culture, as we define it, is a broad term. Often when people hear the term free culture, they immediately think that it's a you don't have to pay for anything culture. This is one of the bad things about the English language, because we only have one word for free. In German, in fact, I think it works a lot better because you have freie Kultur or kostenlose Kultur. So we're not advocating for a cost-free culture, but instead a culture that is free as in speech, as we say. So it should be a free exchange of culture. The joke is that the other kind of culture is free as in beer. And while we all love beer, we don't necessarily say that you shouldn't have to pay for culture. And now, why has copyright, which isn't the only issue in free culture, but has become at least somewhere central in the movement, become so relevant as a cultural movement? In fact, only about 20 years ago, some of my law professors at Harvard had said copyright was such an obscure topic, no one really wanted to take the course. Even law professors found it boring. But now that's all changed. And in fact, as I'm sure after attending this event, many of you know, digital technology has come in and has changed a lot of that. File sharing in the 1990s, Napster and the P2P movement really brought these issues to light, where people realized that they could easily copy a digital file and that copyright was now implicated. Previously, when you only had physical goods, copying an entire book was a much harder task. So to go to a photocopier or a photostat machine or a printing press and make a copy of a book was not nearly as easy as sending your friend a digital file. But as we've discussed throughout this symposium and as we often talk about within the free culture movement, the debate is not merely about file sharing. That's one of the issues that we think about. Some people think that Free Culture is an organization. There is an organization called Students for Free Culture that promotes file sharing. In fact, it's an issue that we often consider and think about, and we want to promote new models for remuneration for artists, but we're not running around saying that everyone should illegally download files. We love legal file sharing. There are examples of people using things like BitTorrent for Creative Commons music or free software. So now I'd like to talk about activism. As Joy had mentioned before, this session is really exciting because we're talking about putting ideas into action. We've had a lot of talk at the symposium about ideas. But how can we take, you know, what's in our heads and apply it to the real world? So one of the first issues that we've taken up in the free culture movement, and not the only, and there are many that I'll talk about, is digital rights management. Let's hopefully my slide will work. Please work. Okay, cool. Several groups of the free culture movement decided to engage in real-world protests about digital rights management. Now, why did we choose DRM? Does anyone not know what DRM is? I'll tell you quickly. And by the way, some people call it digital restrictions management, and some people call it digital rights management. So it depends on which side you're talking to. But it changes the essential nature of a digital file such that you often cannot copy it, or you can only make a limited number of copies of a file. Normally, when you have digital files, they're of a non-rival nature in that if I send you a file, I can have the copy of the file, and so can you. Much like ideas, if I tell you an idea, we can still both have that idea in our heads. Physical goods, or even a physical CD or a physical book, is rival in nature in that if I give you my book or CD, I no longer have it, and you do. What DRM tries to do is to change the nature of a digital file to make it at least partially rival by limiting the number of copies that can be created. So, for example, one of the most well-known types of DRM is the iTunes Fair Play. And that will allow a limited number of files. But as many of my friends have experienced, when their computers crash or they lose their files on their iPod and they have a file stored somewhere else, even having a limited number of potential copies can be very restrictive. Another huge issue with DRM is that it prohibits not only fair use, which is an exception to copyright law in the US, and there are similar provisions in Europe, but also remixing. I know that we'll talk a little bit later today about remix culture, and if you want to remix a file, if there's DRM on it, it will not allow it. Now, hackers, of course, can go in, or even people that are more sophisticated in the technological sphere, and strip a file of its DRM, but in many countries, it's also now illegal to do that. So one issue is that even if there's DRM on a work that is in the public domain, arguably, of course, everything in legal doctrine can be argued both ways, but arguably that could be a violation of these laws that prohibit people from stripping DRM. So as a result, in the Free Culture Group, we've decided that DRM is something that we wanted to fight against. It does not promote this environment of technological freedom that we think supports free culture. So we engaged in several protests, and as you can see here, the RIAA Took My Music Away was a sign that people... Sorry, communications problems. Is a sign that some protesters at NYU Free Culture created, and I think about 30, so not, you know, that many people, but went to a record store in New York and handed out flyers and told people about DRM. And this was at a time when DRM was really coming to the forefront. It was a little bit before the big Sony DRM scandal, but a lot of people were talking about it. And we also engaged in a pledge. there we go, to boycott DRM. My colleague Fred Benenson and myself use a site called Pledge Bank, and we decided, well, we were going to boycott DRM anyway, but the idea behind Pledge Bank is that if you get multiple, a critical mass of people to do what you're pledging to do, then you'll all do it. So we set this kind of small goal of 500 people to boycott DRM, and in fact, it got picked up by major blogs like Boing Boing and the like. And nearly 5,000 people in a month. It also has a set timeline, and we tried to extend it, and we couldn't, because we really wanted as many people to boycott DRM as possible. But within 30 days, nearly 5,000 people had signed up to boycott DRM. And one thing that I think was really great about this campaign was that once people had signed this pledge, they somehow felt really kind of inspired to write about it themselves. So we found hundreds of blog posts where people that were bloggers, because people, I guess, that are bloggers are often into technology and they like to read Boing Boing. And they wrote about the pledge themselves. So when people had signed the pledge, they also spread the word about this boycott of DRM. Now this was for DRM CDs. A huge issue now is also DRM files. Interestingly, within the music industry now, DRM seems to have been largely, it's not extinct by any means. But at a digital music conference that I attended several months ago in New York, I actually heard executives of major labels proclaiming the death of DRM. And I said to my friend, we've got to put this on Twitter because this is really big news, at least that they're saying this from their end. But DRM is still alive and well on things like the Amazon Kindle and in video. So that's something that we're continuing to address now. We also organized a video contest called Down with DRM in conjunction with the Free Software Foundation that has launched a Defective by Design campaign, which seeks to address the issue of DRM and how it ruins your technology. And the idea behind this was that we would invite people all over the world to make videos that spoke out against DRM. And we actually asked the people use Creative Commons licenses, which I'm sure you've all heard about for the last 2 days at the event, and specifically the very free license, so either the attribution or the attribution share alike license. And we put a call out. We also got it on Boing Boing. Luckily, the people at Boing Boing like us free culture people, so they help us spread the word. And I think we got some really amazing submissions. We also managed to have prizes, which I think can help in engaging in this kind of action, organizing a contest, because people are, I guess, motivated by the potential to win something, which was a Neuros OSD piece of hardware to store video. So I would like to actually play two of the submissions. Now that here's the first one. How they did that, but I thought it was pretty cool. And this one is actually my favorite. Thank you. enjoy that one. And the music is licensed Creative Commons as well, which I also really like that song. So with the results of this video contest, I think I was actually really impressed at the creativity of people and the willingness of just anyone out there that was passionate about technology issues and was interested in creating to make such videos. So I would consider that quite a success in our work. Another project that we were working on related to DRM was actually an iPod hacking party that we organized. This was 2 years ago, and it was also during the time after the Sony rootkit era, but before Apple and the iTunes Store had released music without DRM. And there's some debate as to whether they originally had intended that, but the labels didn't want it. But at this point, the iTunes Music Store was still all DRM'd music. So we organized an event at MIT, because it's always great to have the hackers there, where we installed free software, so Rockbox and iPod Linux, on people's iPods. Now, we warn people whenever you're installing new software, things can go wrong. So we essentially told them, look, you better back up your music, because otherwise this may not work. But it went off with great success, and we installed nearly, I think, four dozen installs of Rockbox and iPod Linux on various people's iPods. And one of my favorite things that came out of the event was, I don't know if you guys can read this, but it says, I hacked my iPod. Only at MIT could you have a digital laser etching on demand where people took the cookies that we brought to the party and etched on it digitally. That's also the code for the installer that my colleague Benjamin Mako Hill wrote for the event. So this idea that we can take hardware even and install new software on it and recode it is something that I think is essential to the idea behind free culture. And also, with regard to activism, it need not always be so serious. I'd like to show a video now. And I'm curious as to if anybody can recognize a certain person in this video. Does anyone know who the person with the laptop is? Just scream it out loud. Yes, so that was actually the founder of the free software movement, Richard Stallman. And I think this actually got quite an acclaim on blogs that he was dancing the Soulja Boy, which was a popular dance that my colleague Kevin Driscoll from MIT organized. And his interest is in shared cultural dances. So this is also a part of free culture that so many people made videos on YouTube and other sharing sites of their friends doing the Soulja Boy. And here was his own remix of Soulja Boy with the famous Richard Stallman doing it. But related to that, another issue that we've addressed within free culture activism is free software. So promoting free and Libre open source software, if you want to call it that, but encouraging people to use Firefox, for example, as their browser, or OpenOffice as their office software, or running Linux. And the fact that having code where people can rework it and access the source code and build upon it is a positive thing. So in that sense, we're somewhat different from the free software movement in that we're not only focusing on free software, but free software is definitely a part of what we do in free culture. Now, just quickly, another issue that we've addressed in free culture activism is the idea of open access. Open access is a movement that is started out of academia, mainly to promote access to scholarly research. The way that funding models often work, particularly in the US, but as far as I know in Europe and elsewhere as well, is that when academics publish their work, they do not get paid to publish it in journals. This is not the case for example, textbooks or other books. And they're doing it for prestige and to say that they published in this highly regarded journal. Yet, the prices for journals, even though the academics are not getting paid to do so, have skyrocketed. So much that there are journals that now cost upwards of tens of thousands of dollars per year for an annual subscription for a library. And this is even too expensive for the richest universities in the US. So how could it be that a university in Africa or in South America could afford these journals? So we had a National Day of Action for Open Access that will actually happen again this year on October 14th, if I remember correctly. And we did such things as distributed bookmarks that promoted the idea of open access in libraries all around the city of Boston. And this is great. This is a project called Overprice Tags, where together with my colleagues at MIT, we printed out price tags for all of the journals, and with the librarian's permission, because they're very into the idea of open access, put it on the journals. So now if you'll go, many people unfortunately read the journal, or fortunately, but many people read journals online. But here, if you go to get the paper journal, you can now see the price on it. So a subscription to this journal, Physical Review, would be $19,000.135. So most people are not aware of this huge issue. And in the US, and I would venture to say in Europe and elsewhere as well, much of the research that is published in these journals is taxpayer funded. So we actually pay twice and sometimes three times to access this material. So that's one thing we've addressed. Now, quickly, this is an example of a work that was submitted to our Creative Commons Art Show. There were a series of them around the country. We held one at Harvard. And this is particularly cool because this is all Creative Commons licensed photos then put into a greater Creative Commons licensed work. And we had everything from drawings to animation to video to photos to painting in the art show that we hosted. And the coolest thing about this art show is because all of the works in it were licensed under CC licenses, and we put much of the work online. It's harder if it's a physical painting. But anyone else that wanted to have a CC art show could take the works, and as long as they abide by the license, so as long as they attribute, they could hold their own art show. Quickly, unfortunately, I don't think I have that much time to talk about it. YouTube is a project that we've been working on in Free Culture, where we track the takedown of videos on YouTube. So here you can see there are a variety of videos that were removed from YouTube for either copyright or other related complaints. But the way that YouTube works is there's a law in the US called Digital Millennium Copyright Act. There's a section called 512. Sorry to get into legal mumbo jumbo, but very quickly, YouTube is not liable if they abide by this law. And at the copyright holder's request, take down videos that the copyright holders say is theirs. And there's a process that if it's fair use or if you feel this is wrongly done, you can file a counter notification. But there are many videos being taken down off of YouTube all the time, and YouTube doesn't make this information available and doesn't disclose this. So we made this project to actually scrape YouTube servers so that we could now see what's being taken down off of YouTube. The reason why we did this was particularly for free speech and fair use purposes, to see if there were a lot of videos that were being taken down for these potential purposes. And we've definitely seen that there are videos that were not necessarily a clear-cut case of copyright infringement that were taken down. You can check it out at youtube.org, and this project amazingly got press all around the world because of the popularity of YouTube and the idea that videos are disappearing from there all the time. So thank you very much. I would love to hear all of your thoughts about the idea behind free culture activism, but I think just quickly, this is an area that is still very new, and this is only the beginning. So hopefully with the participation of communities around the world, we can work together to make free culture happen, and also a free as in speech culture, but maybe some gear too. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Elizabeth.